What's up? I'm Benjamin King, and you're listening to the Bold But Gold podcast.
Hello, everyone. It's Walter Wong here, welcoming you to another edition of the Bold But Gold podcast. Now, my guest on today's show is one of the most business-savvy musicians in the industry. In fact, he's more than a musician. He's a screen and stage actor, a composer, a multi-instrumentalist, a singer, and previously a national swimmer. And he's also an all-round good guy. I'm talking, of course, about the one and only Benjamin King. Most of us know Ben as 1/4 of the Sam Willows, which is one of Singapore's most successful English pop music acts ever. The Sam Willows have written some of the most recognizable hits in recent years, including Take Heart, Glass House, and Save Myself. Ben is currently also fronting the sketch comedy series, The Ben Z Project, alongside one of my favourite comedians, Hirzy. But before The Sam Willows and The Ben Z Project, Ben was the archetype of, in his own words, the nerd jock paradox. He spent his schooling years in the Singapore Sports School and represented Singapore in swimming. So listen out for how he found his way from the pool to the stage. Ben has also gone through some of the darkest possible moments in life. He lost his mom at a young age to cancer and, as he tells us in this podcast, the process of overcoming that grief is something that continues to this day. So from personal challenges to his aims as an artist, we cover it all in this podcast. We talk about songwriting, breaking regional markets, kickboxing, sibling relations, Malcolm Gladwell's tipping point, and much, much more. So there's lots to cover, and let's dive straight in. I really enjoyed my conversation with Ben, and I hope you do too. So first and foremost, so we are in Zendo Studios, as you said. This is John's studio. Do you guys, does the Sam Willows record here at all?
We try to.
Yeah.
We try to record here because it just feels like home. And sometimes, like, if you just create a similar, you know, creative setting where you're comfortable with, then for some reason, like, it's easier. But no, with the most of our records, we actually went overseas to record.
Mm-hmm.
Write in Sweden.
Yeah.
But yeah, we do track quite a bit here as well. Yeah. But we also have our home studio. So, you know, being a 2019 musician, you pretty much do it everywhere, like here.
And by the way, this is quite funny, but what does the name Zendo mean?
Like, I have no idea.
Is it Zendo?
I wish it was. Yeah, probably. It's like a funky way of saying Zendo.
Yeah.
It's like those are influences. Zendo? I'm going to put on my Zendo. I have no idea what it means.
It's a good imitation. That's why you're going to acting now. Your imitation of influences.
No, I just need to make fun of people. But no, I don't know why. I think it's just maybe for SEO. Like, it's easy to Google.
That is true. There's no other Zendo. I can promise you there's no other Zendo studios at least in Singapore.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think it was always on John's heart to do that. Like,
yeah.
John being the other member of the band. I think he is such a business mind. Yeah. More so than anything. So I think it always made sense to him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Since we're on this note about John, so I read in a different interview that you gave that, is it true that John is the one that actually instigated you guys to start recording it in the past? Or was a group decision?
In terms of Myers-Briggs, Narelle, Sandra, and I,
here we go.
All the same. We're just like high on empathy, and we just don't do much proper adulting. Yep. So literally nothing would have ever been gotten done if it weren't for John.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like he's, I think he contributes very differently to the band, but I feel like every successful music group or entity needs a John. If you don't have a John, like, then you're not going to get anywhere. Yeah. You're just going to be the artist who complains. Yeah.
And so he's the one that also said, hey, we're going to, like, he's going to open a studio.
Yeah. He makes things happen. He's really as much of a yes man as I'm a, are you sure, kind of man? Because I'm that guy. You know what I mean? I'm like, the artist, like, I don't feel like this is for us. Like, this is, like, not our DNA. And he's like, hey, just do it. Can is can.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? What's wrong? Just do
it. Interesting.
So I think that tension between a creative or, an artist and an entrepreneur or a doer, that conversation is very important.
Yeah. So you're the more artistic.
I'm the wanky one. This is weird, you know.
Yeah.
And over the years we've learned to be objective over things. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He goes like, yeah, you're right, or like, shut up and stop being such a wanky artist.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's cast our minds even further back. Growing up in your household with... So, okay, what I find interesting, right, is you have siblings who follow or have similar interests. That's quite common. Right. But for you and Narelle, you guys have followed, like, a very similar path. You both went to Methodist schools. I think you both swam.
Wow.
You both, I believe...
Yeah, the PI.
In the same band, yep. If my sources know. So you're both in the same band now, making the same music, like...
Yeah.
How did you guys end up doing the exact same things?
She has no originality, like, just copied.
So it's just evolved.
No, it's literally the case. Like, when I started getting to, like, metal and Metallica and, like, doing...
Okay.
And she really got into it as well, you know what I mean?
Okay.
Yeah, so she went to the same school I did when I was younger as well. And I feel like... I think it was natural for us because we grew up in a household that promoted... I think my mom was really cool in the sense that she was try everything kind of mom. You know, like... Let's get you into sports. Let's get you into music, into drama, into whatever. Mm-hmm. And so, like, we really had a lot to choose from, thankfully, as kids. And we both gravitated to, again, the art jock paradox of kind of, like, sports and music. And it just so happens that I think we just like telling stories.
Mm-hmm.
But we're kind of different in the way we do it, of course. Yeah, so it just made sense to, I don't know, start making it official with her.
So what do you mean by different? So, like, how would you tell a story that's different from how...
Over the years, she's definitely become more of a visual storyteller.
Okay.
She likes working with photographers and herself as well. And in the mediums of film and curation, art direction, you know, she's really gotten into that and philosophy. This way we kind of match.
Yeah.
But I think for myself, like, it's just more general. Like,
as
long as I get to oversee everything, a bit of music based stuff as well. Copywriting. Like, so I guess, like, similar, different.
Yep.
In a sense, yeah.
Yeah. In terms of sports and art, right? Like, which one was your main interest?
Oh, it's weird.
In school. Or both.
It's so strange because, like, they were both equally important.
Yeah.
Art took a back seat because my dad was like, swimming is going to be your thing. I was like, okay, swimming's my thing.
Okay.
And so I did that for, like, way too long, like 12 years professionally.
Yeah.
And then I decided, like, it's way too boring and there's no future in it.
Unless in terms of schooling.
I'm not tall, so I had to do the 1500s, 400 meters.
Basically, the longer distances.
The more painful ones, it's just a pain.
Gosh, okay.
But it's interesting because, like, in those days, to me, music was a therapy and art was a therapy. Mm-hmm. You know, back in sports school, like, I would just kind of tab out and, like, listen to my favorite musical tracks, go to the piano in the dining room and just, like, hammer away. And then... Today, the reverse is true. It's like, you know, now that music and drama or, like, you know, whatever, entertainment is, like, the rice bowl.
Yeah.
I'm like, I just want to go hit stuff. Or I just want to go and run.
You swim still? Because swimming is painful. I mean, to me,
it's painful.
It's painful, right? Because it's just you and the blue line.
Yeah.
And it's like...
I don't know, when you get older, suddenly the stupidest things become therapeutic, right? Like, why do people even knit? Like, what is knitting? I'm sorry. But you know what I mean, right?
You get stomped if you do it at the MRT.
Yeah, exactly. What kind of, like, old person trapped in a young person's body, you know? Yeah. But the strangest things become therapeutic.
Yeah.
And the thing that I used to dread was swimming, like, you know, staring at the black line all day.
Yeah.
But now I feel like I do my best creative work while I'm swimming, like I'm thinking, you know? And I think you just start forming rituals as you get older, and these rituals become the hallmark of who you are, you know? So working out, and I'm not, like, the craziest athlete, but, like... Just developing a routine, mixing it up, swimming, and then maybe doing a bit of combat, maybe doing, like, yoga.
Okay.
Like, that variation
shocks my body. Mix, yep.
Yeah. Yes, I'm one of those guys who do yoga.
It's a trend nowadays.
It's
so
very
that's
strange. I don't know why I'm doing it, but yeah. So that becomes a therapy, interestingly. Yeah.
And in sports school, did you guys have CCAs? Like, were you in, or was it just sports, studies, and that's it?
Nobody got time for CCAs in sports school.
Wow,
we didn't. The CCA would be the... sporting academy that we were in, like, it's basically get up, train, school, sleep, like mandatory siestas, train again, study, sleep. That was, like, every day.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then once in a while you had, like, music class, but whatever.
But like, no one listened.
Yeah.
And so did you then have, like, formal music education outside, like, you know, the whole, like, piano lesson, the ABRSM thing?
Yeah. So I took classical. I mean, I had a classical training when I was younger, singing, piano and violin.
Oh, so three different.
Yeah. I stopped all of them. And then I really just picked them up again out of boredom and sheer will, you know?
Like when you were older?
When I was in my teens and stuff. I didn't get the formal training until a bit later. Then I started going, picking up more theory classes and production arrangements.
Is that
everyone does?
Is the music theory, though, important? like the classical theory?
It really depends on like the kind of musician you want to be,
yeah,
and what where you feel you fit in the tapestry of,
yeah,
the industry. Because like I love doing stage work in musical theater. You,
yeah,
do have to have,
you, yeah, okay,
you know, that's some true rudimentary form, yeah, of theory knowledge, and it helps with arrangement as well.
Yeah.
But again, like I grew up studying, you know, your fundamental theory.
Yeah.
But I really got into solfège and the numeric form of like tablature,
mm-hmm,
and I kind of stuck with that.
Yeah.
Until,
yeah,
and even now when I'm like doing my scores, I end up writing numbers everywhere.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how I process it.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Whereas tons of really successful musicians know nothing about theory.
Yeah.
But create stunning, like, you know,
yeah,
pieces. And so again, it's your poison. Like, yeah.
And like when you think back, I guess, to your childhood, like, were your heroes in sports or in music? Was anyone from Singapore? What was there a Joseph Schooling that you looked up to? Was Ang Peng Siong?
Yeah. I mean, Ang Peng Siong was, well, yeah, Ang Peng Siong was my coach for a while.
Okay. So you trained at Farrer Park?
Yeah, no, wasn't at Farrer Park. I was at ACJC.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I know he's got a school at Farrer Park, and that's where I played tennis.
Right, so yeah.
Him, but anyway.
What was the question again?
Like, any heroes from either from Singapore or outside?
So the strange thing was that, like, as much as I loved, acting and,
yeah,
stage work and music, yeah, all my heroes were from the sports world.
Okay.
Like, all, okay, of them. And all of them are basketballers. Like, that's how sad I am.
Okay, so that's how you still watch basketball
now. Your MJs, your Kobe's,
yeah,
your LeBrons.
Yeah.
And later in life, I realized it was really because, like, A, it's cool as fuck.
Yeah.
But B, like, I think it was like a, I think it was just the mentality.
Yeah.
They're really the kind of guys that they, you know, they love the grind.
Yeah.
They love the 4 a.m.s. They love, like, non-stop work. They're in,
yeah,
like, an hour before everyone else in the gym, and they're out, like, way after everybody,
yeah,
else. They,
yeah,
commit to that lifestyle. And that was kind of like their Bible. That was their mantra.
Yeah.
You know, and you don't really hear it from, like, creatives very much. You know, I mean,
yeah,
and I think that was, for me, like, the crazy inspirational thing.
Yeah.
And you could apply anywhere, even as a creative. You, yeah, know, like yeah, you can say, oh, I only get creative like when I get creative. I only write songs when I feel inspired.
Yeah.
You can say that. Or you can choose to be inspired every day at,
yeah,
8 a.m. when you get up,
yeah,
and you write a song, whether it's
around
crap or not. Yeah,
yeah.
It's just the muscle that you're
yeah,
working.
Yeah.
So I think that's why I always gravitated to sporting inspirations more,
yeah,
than anything. Because it was really the old adage of,
yeah,
99%. Perspiration.
Yeah, and like
know,
the whole 10,000 hours.
Yeah, the whole 10,000 hours,
yeah,
elbow grease, and like,
yeah, yeah,
as much as it's glamorized, like, the more you get into it, the more you realize it's so important if,
yeah,
you really want to, like, love what you
do. You,
do you
see that now? I think you do see it, right? I mean, like, some artists do work that way, right? Where,
yeah,
you're like,
yeah,
we're going to write for like 12 hours a day, and then we're going to try it again, and we're going to try it again.
Yeah. But then also people glamorize that,
yeah,
insanely, right? Like, when have you ever met a music producer who does not post stories, like, on Instagram going like, yo, on that slow grind, you know, like, in the
hashtag
studio. Yeah, like, yeah. It's super glamorized.
Yeah.
And that is in itself a detriment too, because you have to learn to play the long game, man.
Yeah.
These guys who do that, like, burn out within the half of a decade.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it for them.
Yeah, it's quite interesting because, like, I mean, I guess if you think about the global pop industry, right?
Yeah.
You're doing a lot of artists who appear for like 3-4 years or producers and then never appear again, even,
yeah,
though, like, the sound didn't go bad or anything. It's just like,
no,
it's burnout or something.
But it's also because I think they stuck to, I mean, there are many reasons why that happens.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Let's, who can we take for an example? Well, I mean, like, yeah, I think maybe it's because they were successful for that one thing.
Yeah.
And then they kept, like, you know, like, hammering
doing
it home.
The same thing. And,
yeah,
yeah.
Or it was really a one-hit wonder kind of thing. I think,
yeah,
if you want to be able to be sustainable in the industry for a,
yeah,
long time, you either have to diversify what you do, wear,
yeah,
many hats, or just keep evolving in terms of,
yeah,
your craft.
Yeah.
And I guess that's why, that's kind of what led me to kind of, like, do a bunch of things.
Yeah.
Maybe not all of them well, but the fact,
yeah,
that I just do a bunch of things. And sure,
yeah,
that I always have something to do, you know?
Yeah. And not just be a one-trick pony, I suppose.
Exactly. And I think that's a tough thing, especially if you go into acting in
yeah,
Singapore, or, you know, if you want to, because if you want to be, for example, an actor, or
mm-hmm,
you just want to be like an entertainer or something along those lines,
yeah,
you're just always waiting for jobs to come,
yeah,
to your lap, as opposed to being able to create work for yourself, which,
yeah,
is, again, like, the way to go forward in 2019. It's just like, how do I be my own boss?
Yeah.
And like,
how do
I create platforms for myself,
mm-hmm,
that can still generate revenue?
Mm-hmm.
So I think,
mm-hmm,
that's the that's the business side of things. That's the John and me speaking.
Which I do want to talk about in a second.
Sure, yeah.
But so one last thing before we talk about sort of the music industry in your career. If you're comfortable talking about this, I know from, again, other interviews you've given that you did lose your mom to cancer, I think, when you were 12, 13 or something, pretty young age. Was it sport? Was it music that helped you get through it? Like, and how did you process, I guess, that grief? Because I know it probably is still not easy, but was definitely not easy back then. It's like a psychologist's chair.
Yeah, counseling session. It's an interesting question. You never... it's just a lifelong thing, man.
Yeah.
You don't really ever get the answer to your question. I think it was a bit harder for me because my mom was extremely religious, like super, super into that. And myself, I consider myself quite spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously the biggest question resounding from that incident is like, why her? Why God, if you promise all these things, you would do something like that, right? So that caused big fragments in my belief system. And so that obviously created a few years of just like doing jack all like nonsense and eventually finding my way again. And so art in that sense becomes therapy, but it also can just like, I feel like art in that case, like amplifies whatever emotion you're currently feeling. It's like a bad drug. You know what I mean? It's like a bad trip. It's like, if you're feeling great, it's like, woo, euphoria. If you're feeling shitty, you're digging your own grave, dude.
You become like Billie Eilish.
even then, like, hey, that's interesting because, art became my therapy. It really did. But sports as well. And I think knowing that, that her legacy does live on, you know, in a sense, like, I just want to kind of honor like what she was passionate about.
Because she wanted you to do music as well.
I mean, so that kind of does sustain you.
Yeah.
But interestingly enough, like, so I really took art as therapy in that way. And I had this really good conversation with Ivan Heng that one time, name drop. I don't know, that's so douchey. But but I was talking to him about art as therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave me this strong-ass caution against it. It was like,
oh, so he's like, it shouldn't be.
Well, I mean, to a certain extent, you can.
Yeah.
But it depends on your involvement.
Yeah.
So he was like, because you know he plays this role as Emily of Emerald Hill, right?
Yeah.
And that's a full body of work. That's like cross dressed to the max.
Yeah. He's and it's 2 hours of just.
Just that, and it's persona, and it's like full in, you know, and he was talking about that procedure, and he's like, and when I'm done with that, I go home. And I take the longest bath in the world. And I scrub every bit of nail polish off my fingers. Yeah. I do a hard reset.
Yeah.
Because if I take it home with me, like, I lose my mind.
Interesting.
Like,
okay.
That is such a method of math. I mean, like, there's just like a cracking open the window to, you know, his method. But it taught me that, like, I can be therapy to an extent. But it's really, like, you got to be objective with it.
Yeah.
You know? Especially if you are outputting as well. If all you're doing is consuming, that's fine. Yeah. But even then, like, you need to be able to consume it in context, I think.
Got it.
So for me, that's why I started sharing a story, because I realized that, like, as much as it gave me closure, it also gave healing to other people. And I never wanted to dilute or filtrate everything that she was into just a great story or a great hashtag. You know,
which is common in today's world, very much.
Absolutely. So I guess that's why I kind of like stayed off that narrative after a while. Like, I used to talk a lot about her, and then now I'm just like, okay, I think it's time to tell other stories, in a sense. Yeah.
Okay. Well, cool. Thanks for that.
No, man.
Pass that one. I talk about, I guess, happier times, which is... So I think I first started noticing your music when people were sharing some of your covers. Or not you, but, you know, of Sam Willows.
Oh, wow.
Online. This was like 2012?
Yeah, 2013.
Long time ago. Yeah.
Scary.
And then suddenly I realized you guys started producing original music.
Yeah.
So how did that jump happen? Like, were you guys always writing together, and then you were like, okay, now we've got some traction, people listen to us, let's put what we want out there? Is that how you guys were thinking?
It's a strange beast among creatives, because the idea of doing covers for a living is just either frowned upon or like people really lean into that, because you can get wildly successful.
Yeah. Because, I mean, look at, a few years back, it was Sam Sui, isn't it?
Sam Sui, and he's still doing it.
Yeah.
Hugo Schneider. He's still up to it. And maybe not so much in this market anymore. Yeah. I think that window has passed already, and we kind of like also felt a bit like tired.
Yeah.
But for us, it was just, especially for me, it was the excitement of, I guess, the same thing, taking a song and fucking it up. You know what I mean? Just really taking just giving it a really hard spin. And I think at the time we weren't the most, I mean, still obviously we're not the greatest, like, we're not all great vocalists and we're not great musicians in our own right, but we tried to find something that worked for us, and then, you know, you put that song DNA in and you see what happens.
Yeah.
But we always wrote originals, no matter what. And I think it's a very easy progression, obviously. Every artist wants to write their own songs. I mean, well, okay, that's not true. But every... I mean, if you have something to say, you eventually want to gravitate to that. And I think we always liked the Murata styles. So it felt natural to kind of go into it.
And so do you guys listen to the same kind of music? Or
not at all.
Is it?
Like, it's scarily different, very, very different influences. Actually... For example, John started out really into like straight up blues.
Is it?
Okay. Yeah, John Bonamassa, Eric Clapton, like old school blues. Sandra has always been really into pop. Niraj's just kind of gone more indie, and I just listened to metal and musicals. Yeah, it's very strange. I don't know what's wrong with me. So this is just a very weird combination of styles, but we all love, I guess, like, because I think for us, pop was an interesting puzzle to crack.
Yeah,
people think pop is easy, and pop dude, pop is so hard to write. And if you ever sit inside a songwriting session for pop, and you see how many kind of roadblocks that the creative people set themselves. First is a 3-minute 30 song. It's got to be catchy. It's got to be accessible. Yet you've got to push creative boundaries. You've got to innovate. You've got to like look at the trends and see in terms of sonic design where you can push. Are you going blue ocean? Are you trying to create something new? Or are you doing a red ocean thing where it's kind of the sound of the season? And what's the risk in that? There's a lot of great conversations to be had about writing an original pop music song. And I think that was a challenge that we relished at the time.
Yeah. Let's talk about that for a second, actually. Because I think what most people don't realize is like the global superstars, right? The pop superstars, obviously they don't write, but the writers write in teams. And the songs are cut up and it's... A bridge might end up being a chorus, and it's teamwork, right? Is that how you guys write, or are you guys more traditional in that sense?
We are a bit more traditional in a sense that we've got like heaps of voice notes, as everyone does. Okay, so usually how it is done, obviously in 2019, is producer gets a bunch of other producers to produce a track with ten producers together. They might just contribute one stem of like hi-hats or whatever, right? And then they get like maybe top liners to come up with different lines. Yeah. And then the singer comes in and sings over it.
Yeah.
And there might not even be the final singer. So then you've got 30 names inside like a Drake song, you know? Yeah. But I think then you've got people today like Charlie Puth, Julia Michaels, who 1975, who still churn out like massive chart-topping hits, but who write all their own hooks. And then you've got trends people like J. Cole and Kendrick, and Donald Glover, who obviously do almost everything, do all their writing themselves. So there is no rule. I think for us, we always wanted to have a hand in it. So in our later albums, although we did get some external help from producers and top liners, it's predominantly us still. Good or bad. So some songs flop because it's us. Some songs get out there and do well because it's us as well. But at the end of the day, it's us. And that's kind of what we always wanted to maintain.
And so Take Heart, was it recorded in Singapore? Or was it... I mean, primarily, I know it's probably not.
Yeah. But... so the final track is probably 60% production.
Yeah, I guess the whole album, but
Oh, the whole album, So if I talk in terms of the whole album, yes, I would say about 50 to 60%, it's demos and stuff that we tracked in Singapore. And half of it was written in Singapore, half written in Sweden.
Okay. Oh, so you actually did go to Sweden at that point.
So we went to Sweden too.
But you weren't on a label yet.
We were with Sony at the time So we signed with Sony in 2015.
Got it.
And so when that track started like coming up, we did a songwriting camp in Sweden. Went there to write like a song a day, just churn stuff out.
Okay, those songwriting camps are amazing. I mean, I've not been to one, obviously, but I read about them and it's amazing. Like,
they're as amazing as they are just like nerve-wracking. Because like, if you think about it,
you're gonna open up, right?
It's like, it's good vibes, there's no pressure, let's all get together and chill. But there is this like gnawing sense in the back of your mind that you've got 2 weeks and a massive A&R budget to write like the songs that will last you for the next 2 years in the span of 2 weeks. Every day coming in, what are you feeling today? Write a new song. In itself, there is immense pressure, but you cannot allow the pressure to seep in. You kind of have to like stay that pressure at the back of your mind and go like, we just here to chill and vibe and write our best song. Oh my God, pressure. How the fuck am I writing the song? So it's such a strange combination. Which again, produces a really great song, or it could just produce nonsense. You know, so... But sometimes, like, the songs are already written. Like, for Take Heart, that was that song itself was written, like, way back. Nora and I wrote that, like, months before we went in, and we already knew exactly what we wanted from the production. So giving it to the producer and getting him to finish up our stems, it was, like, super easy.
Take Heart was sort of, I guess, split Singapore and Sweden, and then I Know But There, it's I Know But
I Know
Where.
But Where, yeah.
Yeah, sorry, I keep saying I Know Now But Where, it's not. It's I Know But Where. Was that more in Sweden in the songwriting camp, or was that also sort of like pre-written and then you brought some stuff?
So we, for that album, it was very strange. We went on a solo songwriting camp, just the four of us.
Individually?
To Sydney. Okay. Sydney. Well, I mean, as a group, we just went to Sydney.
Okay.
Rented an Airbnb and just sat there.
Oh, so just yourselves?
Yeah, yeah.
Trapped in an Airbnb.
We did. We wrote some really good songs.
Yeah.
All demos. Came back.
Yeah.
And then sometime after that, we flew to Sweden to work with these other guys, these great guys. And we presented all these demos. And they were like, hey, like, you guys take the pick of the litter, like, whatever you want. Like, we're down to, like, break it apart, restructure it. They took, like, one song.
So, like the rest of them, like, nope.
Yeah. And then we're like, we really like some of the other songs. You know what I mean? Because it really felt like us. And we knew that it wasn't really this Swedish vibe.
So, was it because of that? Because they were like, it can't sell. So, they didn't want to...
Well, I think maybe in their minds, it couldn't sell. But to us, like, it really could work. There were some really awesome bangers in it. And it was stuff that, I guess, like, we knew how to perform live.
Yeah.
You know? But I guess to them, they had a very educated preconceived notion of where pop should go, because they have songwriting schools that churn out top K-pop hits.
Yeah, they're Swedish.
You know? Yeah, they're Swedish. Yeah. And so, we're like, okay, lah, whatever lah. We'll just go with the new songs that we're writing with them.
Yeah.
And we just took one old song and that would be it.
Yeah.
And so that was I Know But Where. It was just all songs that we wrote in Sweden. Still us, but with a heavy, like, sort of Swedish influence inside.
How difficult is it for you to accept that these songs and...
For me, it was really tough.
Because, it's in your heart.
I'm very precious with these songs.
Yeah.
But again, I knew that I wasn't writing it for myself. I was writing it for the band.
Yeah.
And
but you guys wrote it all together.
We all wrote it together.
As a group,
yeah,
you guys were okay. Yeah. Actually, just letting it go,
because you kind of see the point.
Yeah,
some of these songs, like, they are so raw, and you feel like, again, you know, like when you place against people like them who've written for megastars and everything, and you're like, yeah, they're probably right. Yeah. Like, you know, they probably have more experience than I do, and who am I, this kid in the bedroom who decides he can write pop songs? You know, and you put your song next to theirs, and you're like, let's just go with theirs. But then you go home after like 6 months, and you look at your song, it's like, wow, it's actually damn good lah. Yeah. I'm actually not too bad. Like, you know.
So do you guys still perform the ones that you wrote?
No, we don't. I mean, once in a long while, we might whip it out, and like fans are like, oh my god, like people who know, and they're like, we've heard this before, we love it. Yeah. But again, I think we told ourselves that, you know what, we're not really, the nature of the Sam Willows, we're not, as much as it is for ourselves.
Yeah, it's also for...
It's really for... I mean, we were called, and we felt like we were made for a large demographic.
Yeah.
You know, like you're... Not to say lowest denominator, but like, you know, easy listening and accessible.
Yeah.
And we're trying to push where we went to musically. Yeah. We tried to, you know, be a bit more inventive. But at the end of the day, we wanted to write music for people.
Yeah.
You know, so that was a sacrifice.
And it's quite interesting how you made a caveat of, like, not lowest common denominator, but... It's actually more difficult, I feel, to write a song that everyone likes than only you like, you know?
It's so hard, Especially knowing that you can write something that will satisfy your artistic sort of button and some other people as well.
Yeah.
And to kind of like chuck that aside and go, nah, this four chord song with these hooks, it's going to blow up.
Yeah.
Or it's going to be, not blow up, but it's going to hit the right people, you know? And so, and this is the thing, I think, like, a lot of creatives... always try to fight. They try to fight intrinsically what makes people like them, you know. And it's a tough conversation, because you might not like the reason why people like you. For example, like, you know, that's the big problem with a lot of artists. And so they try to break that for their own sanity, and they do their own thing, and then it doesn't end up being commercially viable or successful, which is fine if that's not their goal, and they want to make peace with themselves and do art they love. Then by all means, chase that to the end of the earth. Like, do that. But if again, at the end of the day, you want to reach people and you want to be successful or something, then you have to look at, I guess, what made you in the first place in their eyes.
Yeah.
And for us, it was, you know, easy listening songs or, you know, like group harmonies.
I was going to say the harmonies. Sing part, strong melodies as well. It's not single notes.
Yeah, exactly. Arrangements that are hooky and band dynamics, you know, and that was our thing. And so when we went away from that for a bit, people were like, oh, where's the old Willows? We missed the old Willows. Yeah. And we're like, yeah, we miss it too. But
which was the phase where you went away from that? Are there specific tracks that you released that?
I think somewhere in between the first EP and the first album was where we were at heart, you know, and where the core fan base kind of recognizes us for. But at the end of the day, we also wanted to evolve. We also like other music styles. So it'd be silly to not evolve and challenge ourselves.
Is music a profession or a passion?
Dude, it's a straight up profession, man.
Okay.
Which is why I also kind of like had to take time aside, like away from it, just to remind myself of why I even loved it in the first place. Mm-hmm. And I think that was important. Yeah. Especially if it's going to be a rice bowl, you've got to like find a sauce.
Yeah. Interesting. I mean, this question comes up because there's a saying in football that Italians see football as a profession, or the Brits see it, or the English see it as a passion.
And why do they suck? Sorry, I'm just kidding.
They also won three or four World Cups, I think.
So yeah, exactly.
That's probably why.
Oh, that's interesting. That's an interesting thought, yeah.
Yeah, because I think you approach it differently. Like, I mean, it's what you said, right? If it's a profession, you would do things that you like as well, but of course you need to do things that the market likes.
Correct.
Or if it's just purely a passion, it is, you know, you in a bedroom and that's it, right?
Yeah.
So, but anyway.
But I've met artists who have married both seamlessly.
Yeah.
You know, and when you see someone like that, you're just like, oh my gosh, like, you are the goal. You know what I mean? It's almost like, and it takes years.
Yeah.
And I'm going to cite my friend Cesare here, who spent years reinventing himself, believing that there was a successful end to the story.
Yeah.
You know, because he did Idol.
Yeah.
And then he had to go to NS straight after that.
Yeah.
You know, and he had to dismantle his whole persona.
Yeah.
He stopped using the Idol label as his image.
Yeah.
He stopped calling himself Singapore Idol and Cesare. You know, he was just like, I'm a singer-songwriter.
Yeah.
And I'm moving away from, you know, Ken Lim approved
ballads.
And I'm just going to write my own stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, he wrote some stuff that hit, some stuff that didn't. Yeah.
His album last year, that retro 70s, 80s
there you go.
Swingers. Yeah.
But it took a long time to get there. And it was a constant conversation with him, his musicians, the label. Yeah. He's a label mate with us as well.
Interesting.
And when we finally landed on, I think it was Fire to the Floor in 70s.
Yeah.
And then now with this Mirage, they were like, and it's you, right? They're like, this is the sound. We got it. It's the perfect storm.
Yeah.
And he loves writing stuff like that.
Yeah.
The dude is a monster writer. He writes like every day. He practices every day.
Yeah.
And he still loves music to death. He consumes it. He does research on it. He goes to gigs. And he still outputs the same way.
Yeah.
And it's commercially viable. It's very successful. And I'm like, that's kind of the goal. It's where you want to be.
And I guess in terms of personality as well. So I watched him last year at Pink Dot, actually.
Yeah.
And I was very surprised. I mean, stereotypes or not, but I think he's Muslim. I mean, he's Malaysian. I think he's Muslim. And I know his market probably is Malaysia, Indonesia. For him to be at a LGBT event is...
Let's not get started on that.
Yeah, let's not go in there. I'm just saying...
That's crazy, too. Yeah. And so, you know, people like him, like Hirzy...
Who
just put about their lives on the line that way. Yeah. And they're very convicted with who they are.
Yeah.
It's very brave. It's very, very brave. So Cesare is one of those guys I like super look up to because just who he is. Yeah.
And let's not go into the politics.
No, man.
From there. Yeah. Sorry, just one more thing about let's talk about the non-music stuff. But in terms of the music stuff, when you guys were signed, right? Like, how big of a moment is that? How do you feel when you were signed by Sony?
Wow. It was big.
Yeah.
Because I think we wanted it for a long time. Yeah. But because of
and so that was an aim. It wasn't an exit. Like, that was actually something you were working towards.
Correct. We worked towards a deal for about a year, actually.
It
took a long time to get to the deal. Yeah. And we were with the new wave of signees, actually.
Yeah.
So the story behind it is EDB released a grant.
Oh, is it? Okay, interesting.
I guess this is public knowledge. Yeah. So EDB released a grant to all major labels in Singapore who at the time were not managing artists 360.
Mm-hmm.
They were basically doing licensing, publishing, you know, and their main source of revenue comes from the region, right? It's not from domestic at all.
Yeah, it's so small.
So EDB was like, man, we got to grow the scene. We got a bunch of new artists out in town who could potentially be good exports to the region.
Yeah.
So it was people like ourselves, General Bones at the time. Yeah. He was also picked up at the same time as us.
Charlie as well.
Charlie was a bit later, but
a year or so.
A year or so later, he signed with Universal.
Yeah.
But the first wave was us, I think, and Oh, Nathan was picked up. No, maybe Nathan was signed a full contract after that.
Okay.
But we were one of the first few who did 360 deals. Mm-hmm. So
and so that's writing.
No, and... so that means not only are you licensed and published by the record label, you're also managed. They're your booking agents, they're your managers, and that usually
and all the merch stuff as well. Comes correct. There as well.
Okay. Well, I mean, those are all separate negotiations that you can have. But I think up until that point, that wasn't really a practice. And even in the States, you've got independent booking agents.
Yeah.
Promoters, managers, and then the record label is a separate entity altogether. So it's multiple conversations happening at every one time. Mm-hmm. But in Singapore, everything is kind of streamlined in this case. So,
because the market's small.
The market's small. Yeah. So it was a great feeling. And the great thing about labels, as opposed to, let's take, for example, other talent management agencies out there who manage artists or hosts. Being an, if you're an actor versus an artist, right, the management style is completely different because as an artist, you need to be extremely selective. You have your own imagery. Mm-hmm. And the great thing is that there is a budget set aside for recording. It's your A&R budget and your marketing budget. So that money goes back to your music videos, you know, your recording and whatever publicity. And that's actually, that doesn't really happen anywhere else in the industry. No other agency invests back into the artist. At least not in Singapore. It's not like a career scenario, you know? So that was really big. The fact that there was an ecosystem. We brought in gigs, we brought in sponsors or whatever. That money in turn doesn't just feed the label. Yeah. It goes back to feeding the artist's growth. Yeah, so it was a very nice symbiotic thing. But I think it also, being signed as a major label does rub off differently on some people. Clients, fans, they go like, oh, I guess now you're...
allowed or something.
Yeah, you know, and a narrative... that kind of narrative in a community this small is really toxic.
Interesting.
Yeah, really. Because it's really a crabs in a bucket theory. It's like, if you're going to be critical of people who get signed to major labels here, then no artists will ever break out of Singapore. You know what I'm saying?
You can never export your sound anymore.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's not up to the label to do it, clearly, but it definitely is the engine.
Yeah.
You know, we've really benefited from the major label routes in a sense of regionally when we decide to put together a promo tour to the surrounding countries. And to build fan bases. Yeah. It's really the connection we have with Sony Music Indonesia or Malaysia that allows us to build, like, you know, just a base. And therefore, we do 4 promo tours, go back, do a show, there's a crowd of people who know you. Mm-hmm. So that's, I guess, the upside of a, you know, major label.
And so if you think about the region, have you guys had to change your sound in any way for the region? Because, I mean, it's different, right? The way, or maybe not change your sound, but have you guys had to... position yourself differently in the market in different countries. So it's like the weef.
Well, you can't show your bus line and armpits in Indonesia, but that's
one example. That's hilarious. Yeah.
Then you see a video of, you know, your bandmates getting the armpit censored, and then there's like this dude, so funny. But no, but I mean that all that stuff aside, like I think for us, our challenge was to maintain the integrity of our English music.
Yeah.
And see if it indeed could work in this region, you know? And then, you know, you could drop like a Bahasa cover or something, you know? And it did. It kind of worked decently. I think the challenge is sustaining the travels. You got to be at a place, you know, to incentivize people to listen to you.
And so I was going to say, like, because if you think about, I mean, different parts of the region, they might not even stream music. I mean, a lot of them do, but not all of them do.
That's true. That's
perform
true.
Live all the time.
Or even if they can, for example, like Japan, they're still all about CDs.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're still all about the physicals. Although they have massive technological advancements, they're all about CDs. You know, so again, it's every consumer pattern of every country and demographic is very different.
Yeah.
Like ringback tones are still a thing in Malaysia, Indonesia. Okay. You know what I'm saying? So like that, for the longest time, was the main source of royalty revenue.
So then did you have to shorten your songs just to make sure that it met the ringback tone?
Oh, no. I mean, I don't think we ever really got heavily into that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but isn't that so interesting? It's just like, wow, that is their main source of royalties. Yeah. That's crazy. Yeah.
Interesting. In terms of trying to get into like Philippines, Indonesia, Japan, you guys had a tour, I guess, each of these places. And
I think it was... You know, you can try so hard at a country or, you know, at a place and nothing ever really bites.
Yeah.
And it really, again, it's not about making it big there. It's about just wanting to play music overseas. You just wanted to get out there and just like, just meet different people and play. And I think we weren't massively successful everywhere, but one of the best places for us was... So ever since 2016, we've been doing maybe like 1 or 2 promo tours a year in Indonesia. Mm-hmm. Just going up there. and just like slogging it out, like waking up at 3 a.m. doing it like a 5 a.m. morning show, and then they've got a billion radio stations, so you're doing like 6-7 of them a day, and you're going through the motions, and it's just exhausting.
Last one, you're like...
And it's for a week, and you don't even see any tangible growth. I mean, you do get some fans on social media popping by and saying hey, but you don't really see the effects of what you're doing. And then finally last year we're like, let's just do a proper show. So we managed to get on the lineup for We The Fest last year, which is the festival in over there. And then they bumped us up to this big stage, and we're like, there's no way we're gonna get.
Is it the main stage?
One of the main stages.
Okay.
And so we're expecting at best 200-300 people. Like, okay, and possibly like passive festival goers and everything, right? So whatever. And then we got there, and there were 3,000 people.
Okay.
And they weren't passive because they knew all our lyrics.
They were from Indonesia, like.
They were from Indonesia, from all around the world. I mean, mostly Indonesians.
Yeah.
And they had choreo to our songs. They knew lyrics.
That's amazing.
They were going ham, and we're like, yo, we didn't even know none of this. Yeah. You know, and I guess it just is a testament to really being there, really like plowing the ground, and like you gotta put yourself there. You can't just like stay in your ivory tower in another country and just hope people will like you. You know, you gotta really like do the legwork, get out there.
Yeah.
So that was a big lesson for us. Of how it worked, and for every time it worked, there's a lesson or where it didn't as well. Yeah. So you never really know until you try.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Wow. So you have a hidden Indonesian fan club.
Yeah, but the thing is, we haven't been back since, and it's kind of a bummer. Yeah.
Yeah. Earlier, you mentioned about you try to keep the songs to about 3 minutes, 3:30, and I know how the streaming economy works. I'm always curious about this, but do you write actually to optimize for that, where you give the hook early, you don't whack about the 1 minute intro. You just give it to them so they spin the song full.
Gone are the days of like minute long intros. But the crazy thing about pop these days is that the rules are continuously being broken.
Yeah.
Like Billie Eilish, like J. Cole, like Drake, like K. Dot. Like everyone who chats nowadays chats with a ridiculous song that doesn't make sense. Bazzi has a new song that's that doesn't even hit 2 minutes.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. I think so. Yeah. I mean, his songs are generally very short. They don't even go past the middle eight. It's just like second chorus, that's it.
Yeah.
That's a new thing. Like, for example, like lots of Drake's chart topping songs are devoid of structure. They don't make sense. Or they just, you know, they have like three different beats in a song.
Yeah.
So whatever. You know, really, it's like, who gives a shit?
Yeah.
You know, again, it depends on the genre you do. People are a bit more forgiving with the newer age genres. But if, especially in this market in Asia, where they really like the ballads and we're a little bit, I guess, behind in that sense, you do have to stick to the formula. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we've definitely written songs that lay out the hook straight away.
Yeah.
There's no formula to it, any of the day. And songs that we generally think won't do well. And vice versa. I will honestly say that our latest single, I Cannot Stand.
Which one's it? It's
called Thirsty.
Okay, so that's
me, I just like, I mean, I dig it. It's not too bad. Yeah. I mean, I had a
hand so writing definitely it. Definitely not the one you wrote in
But Sydney. It's not my favorite. Yeah. It's not one of my favorite tunes. I just find it like, ugh. But straight off the bat, when, you know, we do test listenership, people are like, yo, this is a dope beat. Like, we like this song. And I'm like, okay, sure. You know? Yeah, so again, like, you kind of realize that taste is so subjective.
Yeah, yeah.
And the songs you think will work well might not work well with others. Yeah. Again, there's no rule.
Yeah.
Which is very liberating but very scary as well.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? Yeah, it's a very strange phenomenon,
I think. It's kind of because like streaming has really disrupted the whole market. I mean, for years absolutely. It went from LPs to like CDs, but I mean like
to like streaming. Napster
LimeWire and Kazaa.
Yeah, oh my gosh. PirateBay.com.
Yeah. Well, we don't use any of that.
No, not at all. No, very law abiding.
Yeah.
We're not smoking in this room right now, we're not.
But we actually are not. So that
Which is very liberating, I think.
Yeah,
it gives you hope that, you know, the intellect of, you know, music consumers is widening.
Yeah.
And therefore, as artists, we can in turn explore. But this is the weird supply and demand theory. It's like, why aren't we the ones pushing things, you know? And I'm sure that a lot of artists who do push things.
Yeah.
And it is really the theory of tipping point. If you ever read the book Tipping Point, about when a cultural phenomenon has a seismic shift that brings it from mediocre sort of trend to like worldwide. It's like, I think one of the case studies was Hush Puppies, and how like Hush Puppies went from like, they didn't do one massive thing. They did a bunch of small campaigns. Yeah. But in the 90s, suddenly it became the brand, you know, of comfort.
Yeah.
Right? And it was like...
My parents bought a lot for me. So.
Yeah, right? But I mean, yeah, and exactly. And they're so timely as well. They only exist in a certain time frame, right? How does that happen? And you look at meme culture today.
Yeah.
Like, just look at, like, the transient nature of memes. Yeah. And memes are the new metaphors, right? Like, they've totally... There are courses in the US and the universities dedicated to just meme culture and internet speak, which is freaking incredible.
Yeah.
It just goes to show that if you don't evolve with the times, if you don't learn, like...
You'd be left behind.
Yeah, you'd be left behind. And you cannot... That's why when creative agencies come to you or like when clients come to you, hey, we want to do a viral video. Like, ganina, like, what do you mean viral video? Like, you cannot like...
Everyone wants to do a viral video.
Can we do like a challenge, a 10-second challenge? Like, no, you cannot just say this video is going to go viral. It never goes viral if you do it.
Yeah.
You know, like you can try.
Yeah.
But it's like taking a shot at the dark. Like, you don't know what's going to happen. You just...
Yeah.
It's stupid. Want to do a viral video? What the...
I like how you dropped in the influencer accent.
Yeah. Shoot the film, you know? Talk like this. It's just, I can't deal with it.
Very good.
Yeah.
Oh.
No, but in fairness, you can create a song or a video or a campaign that you know will impact people, obviously. Yeah. You cannot think it will go viral. But, and one example is, I guess, like, the project I'm doing, the Benzi project. Like,
let's talk about that.
The episodes that... we thought we're going to blow up, didn't blow up. And the episodes that we didn't think we're going to blow up, blew up massively. So we're always continuously being proven wrong as opposed to what resonates with people. Yeah.
The Benta Project. So how did that come about? And I mean, I know it's part of your, I guess, let's call it a musical sabbatical. A band sabbatical for a short while.
I've always really wanted to tell stories aside from music.
Yeah.
Because I kind of started doing theater, and acting at the same time as music. And if you ask me, that brings me like crazy amount of joy. Like it's so much more fun because it's so much more dynamic. Mm-hmm. So many more things could go wrong, which is the great part of it. And the Benzi Project really came about because I wanted to say things that I couldn't say through my current medium, as who I am, answering to my agency and like you know, the music persona.
Yeah,
I really want to talk about stuff, you know. And I need it. I need help, to be honest. I've been a big fan of like sketches since I was born, like post school British comedy, the kind of like, you
Black
know,
Adam, all that stuff.
Blackadder, Monty Python, the whole works. Like I love it. Even SNL, even the trashy shit.
Yeah.
Like I'm there for it.
It's
all right. I mean, some are good, some are all right.
Yeah.
But then I definitely needed someone who had that language built inside of him.
Yeah.
Here's he. Who's really just a genius by all means. Really, really intense as a guy.
Yeah.
But like, if you focus him right, man, he writes amazing and he's so natural with it. And I guess I wanted to write comedy that wasn't exactly laugh out loud slapstick. Like it's definitely not gonna make Toggle, you know? But it had layers, like it had social commentary.
Yeah.
The best comedy makes you think. Makes you laugh and go, shit, that's me.
The stuff on there about like, you know, Chinese guy in a Muslim household.
There you go. Internalized racism, reverse racism, classism, privilege. The social classes, Singapore basically. Yeah. There's so much. It's just a hive of comedy, just like you know, embedded in our system that needs to be talked about.
Yeah.
And in this day and age, you can't talk about it because if you talk about it, people have a rebuttal, and it's just going to be this left versus right thing that just descends into a Facebook comment. But if you frame it in comedy, people don't realize they're talking about it and they laugh at it.
Yeah.
You know, parents who have been instilled with bigotry since the day they were born against, you know, like homosexuality or race, they will laugh at these projects and go, oh my god, this Tawakwa, or like, you know, this like, oh, this Mapo, you know, this Malay family or Chinese family is so funny.
Yeah.
And they laugh at it and like, they go like, and after a while it's like, yeah, but that's not right, or so, you know what I mean? And then for some reason it skews their perception a bit.
Yeah.
And they're able to see the bigger picture.
It's like chipping away at the edges, basically.
Correct. Because now they're looking at it from the outside view. It's like that episode with called The Halal Gap, where, you know, you have a makcik who has interact with her future son-in-law, who's not only not Muslim, half Japanese, but vegan, like the ultimate millennial.
Yeah.
And therein lies the comedy. You don't have to write funny lines. You just put them in a room and you see what happens. And therein lies just terrible situational comedy.
Yeah.
And you get a lot of people who go like, you know, I pity the dude, but he's asking for it as well. Yeah. I understand why she's like that. In a sense, there's reverse racism as well. It's like, are we anticipating to be offended? You know, is that everything really offensive? You know, and the conversations that arise from just that one episode have been so healthy.
Yeah.
And the thing is, we're not limited to any world, any style, yeah. anything. We're looking to do like a period piece next season, like a World War II piece.
Okay.
And a full musical piece as well.
Like a Yanzi Palace
thing. Yeah. It's going to be really fun. So, I think there's so much wealth to be uncovered.
And do you write it with him or is it more him?
So we kind of, we don't really do, okay, so we do like a writing session where we kind of like put out the log lines or one-liners of what we want to do.
Yeah.
And he goes, okay, I'm going to write this one. Yeah. And we just kind of like form the beats of the episode with each other, the 3X structures. Mm. Then we go away and write on our own, which is better, to be honest.
Yeah.
Come back, and then we workshop it. Yeah. But then most of it, it's really improv on the day itself, which is
and he's so good at it. I mean, he's a good
dude. It was so funny. It was like one of the skits we did was this one called Code Switching, where it's about the exchange of accents. It talks about culture.
But wait, who was that guy?
Andrew Marco?
Yeah, who is he?
Flat out genius. He's a friend of mine for the longest time. Okay. And he's like the god of accents, right?
Is he doing it for fun or is he like a comedian?
Nah, he's a stage actor.
Okay.
And musician. And so like, I've always wanted to write a sketch just for him to like flex.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is the perfect scenario. And I remember the line that he or she was supposed to say, because... He goes, hey, you cannot make Malay jokes. And then Andrew is like, no, I'm Peranakan. And his line was, subculture is not culture. On the day he just went, Peranakan is a state of mind. Yeah? But if they choose to make it tourism, then he just went on like this, like 30 second. And Andrew is trying so hard not to corpse over there. And we're just dying of laughter. That's Hirzy. And then eventually he made the cut. Like,
yeah.
I guess that's the beauty in a loudmouth emo person like him. Just goes.
Yeah.
Train of thought.
Yeah. And your, I mean, Sony is okay with it. Like...
Yeah, I think because it's a different world almost. Yeah. I really don't brand it as my own thing. It's Benzi is his own thing. The only tie is, I guess I do most of the scoring and the instrumentals. Yeah. So like that's where I get to have fun a little bit. But it doesn't really have, it doesn't really impact the other side of me. Yeah. Yet it is part of me in a big deal. I mean, the goal is obviously to like be able to do like a Donald Glover sort of like Gambino thing where he can create.
It's really performance art, man. Like,
dude, he's intense. Yeah. But you gotta get to the level first, you know.
Yeah.
And he's creating TV shows and writing at the same time. Then he comes up with a cultural piece like what he does.
I mean, and be honest, I never knew he was Childish Gambino.
Like, you should not.
Yeah.
Oh man.
Until maybe like a year ago.
But you caught him in TV and other stuff.
Yeah. Donald Glover, and you're like
the community.
Look familiar, but being racist if I say that. So you know what I mean, like. And then like, oh wait, actually they are the same person.
Yeah. He's one of those guys that can really code switch. It's like, he's just a creator. You know, he wants to tell stories at the end of the day. And he's so good at it. And he's not going to shove his message down your face.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He's going to serve it in a nice like entree. And you go like, oh shit, that's what I'm supposed to be thinking about. You know, internalized racism in America. Like that's such a big thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just the devastation of what America is today, but clothed in an entertainment song. Which is essentially what it is.
Yeah,
it's crazy. Yeah. It's nuts. Yeah.
Yeah, it's I think it's cool because like, I mean, Donald Glover yourself, you guys all. I mean, you also did movies, branching to TV.
Right. Yeah.
Musical and stage, like it's everything.
Yeah, but it's. I think the problem with that is that again, you're a master of none.
Yeah.
And you really have to. You're always learning on the job.
Yeah.
You know, and so. That's the challenge in itself.
Yeah.
I wish I had more time to do like stage work and TV because I really want to get good at that. It's just if you don't commit enough time to it, it's difficult.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And do you think you're getting better at one more? Like, will one become your spike in a way?
Right now, the most fun thing is writing for TV and acting as well. And I think my gripe with a lot of, I guess, local work I've done in TV is that. Firstly, there is a market. People will always complain that there's no market.
Yeah.
And that's why there's shitty work and no one watches it. No, that's not the truth. The truth is that like there is a market who are easily tabbing out to like Netflix or, you know, like K-pop or whatever for their content. But like if you can create work that resonates here and that is still accessible, it's not impossible. You just gotta get a really good script. It really stems from the core of things. You know, at the end of the day, whether a song is good or not, it's not about the music video or the art, it's really like the song. A song can really travel. Same thing. If a script is good.
Yeah.
And if the script furthers not only the plot, but the characters as well. And if you write knowing what your actors can do and not try to be something else, then the show is going to do well.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what language it is. It definitely will. And I think that's the puzzle that we're all trying to solve. It's like, how do you create like a local production show that people will actually share, even if it's on a platform like Toggle?
But I'll venture to say that actually, I think the audience is now on YouTube. Like, if you look at Herzy or... I mean, that's where... My guess is they get more viewership than what you traditionally see as...
You really
the
do.
The media.
I can safely say,
yeah,
you get almost 10 to 20 times the viewership.
And you can see the numbers, which is even better.
But there is no funding there. La. I mean, the funding comes from networks and, you know, getting your show on sync.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's like, oh, how do you... I think that's a struggle for Benzie as well. It's like everything up to this point has been a passion project.
Yeah.
We've been funding it on our own. Yeah. And like there's no way to fund it without a network or without getting sponsors involved. And you don't want to be too heavy handed with, you know,
and
like
you drop sponsorship
product placement. Like, and that's tough. But then hopefully people these days understand that we need to do that in order to even get by and create content, you know? And we definitely don't want to start doing 10 types of aliens, you know, like we're not that little people.
Not naming anyone. But...
No, but again, like I'm not criminalizing that
No, I know
kids love that shit.
It's like a million, 5,000 million views.
Tian Hao is a freaking genius. Yeah. I'm just going to say it right now. Yeah. Like, say what you want about his content, but the dude's a genius. Like, he's, I don't know, I've never met any kid like him who's able to just, like, expand so well. You know, he's crazy.
And he knows his market. That's just, from a business point of view, he has segmented his market.
You don't even know half the things the initiatives he started.
Yeah.
Besides having a charity, and now he's doing a talent agency and a kids channel.
Yeah.
Dude's rolling in it and he's crazy good.
Yeah.
Yeah, you may not like his video of 14 types of people in a fire, but like, it's not about that. It's like, that's what the kids are really into.
Yeah.
And not even in Singapore, in this region.
Yeah,
you know?
He's massive. Like, he's grown his business. Like,
it's huge. You have to respect that.
Yeah.
You have to respect that. Like, even people like NOC or whatever, like they're still around where all the other competitors have died out.
Yeah.
And the older generation continues to look down on the YouTube generation and say that they're not doing real content, they're not real creators.
Yeah.
These dudes are earning shitloads of money, shitloads of views, and bringing in clientele. And you're telling me that they're not successful? They're like crazy successful, you know? And it's just, it bothers me a little bit. Yeah, which is why I think for Benzie, we know that we're not straight up, we know our demographic.
Yeah.
We know it's, I guess, a slightly more highbrow.
Yeah.
And it's not
more, more like social commentary as well.
Correct.
More satirical,
it,
like,
it's more satirical, and like, and from the analytics, most of our fans are from 23 to 38. Like, that's the age group, you know? It's not for 12-year-olds.
It's the high disposable income.
Yep!
So, hey, company.
Hey, man! Yeah,
some
hit us up with some funding.
We were drinking vodka drinks today and Yo's as well. Just
Very product placeable. No, but it was interesting because when we first started Benzie, I remember we were trying to get a bit of ad buy on Facebook.
Yeah.
Because we were using Facebook then. We weren't on YouTube yet.
Yeah.
And so we and our social media guy, we kind of put up like a bit of ad dollar spin on it using keywords that made sense. For example, the Sand Willows, We're Not Here Z, stuff we've done previously.
Yeah.
Even for myself, like putting up on Instagram, you know what I mean? And you realize that, people know about it. Your fans know about it. People who follow the Willows know about it. Does not translate.
Really?
No one, hardly any translation. It. Yeah, it made such a small dent. Like, you realize these days that even if a kid who is like 15 loves the Sam Willows pop music, doesn't necessarily mean he's going to be a Benzie fan because there's so much content these days. Like, he's going to go like, Ben's in it, but I'm just going to go watch Naruto or something. You know, like he's going to flip out. I mean, he's going to tab out. And people just are not that hardcore anymore. But we started putting in things like meme culture, internet language, you know, like wokeness or race, right? And then that exploded.
Yeah.
And then the Halgap went on. It exploded in Malaysia and Indonesia.
Oh, is it? So it's actually okay.
Absolutely. And then because every episode tackles a different thing, each, you know, it just really went into that world, which is really fun to do. Yeah.
Interesting. So it's really the fusion of the media landscape, man. Like, I mean, everyone talks about this. It's crazy.
And even now, companies like SGAG, you know, they're moving into like the video content right now, and they're doing web series stuff, and they're trying to push their audience into new areas, which is noble.
Yeah,
especially after you've got a big cache of people. It's like, how do you now educate these people, bring them to the promised land? You know what I mean?
Yeah,
that's the step for creatives, I think.
What's next? What's on the horizon? So, Benzie is one.
Doing solo music this year.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the band is kind of like we're moving into a different period where we're where we're looking more to solo projects for
but
now.
Sony didn't sign you for a fixed album deal? It's
Well, we're still on a contract with Sony.
Okay.
But we are also as individuals as well.
Okay.
So I think the plan is to kind of well, I mean, we're moving into a solo music period right now.
Yeah.
So everyone is dropping different things, and it's exciting lah, because it's fun to finally see how each of us change as solo artists.
Yeah. Are we gonna get a John singing thing? Is John gonna be on vocals?
I think he is. I think he's gonna do something. Yeah.
Is he gonna do blues?
So, the thing is, I would love for him to do a blues thing.
Yeah.
So you just, I don't know, maybe like have it like an R&B lick over like a straight up dirty blues.
Yeah, just like a 3-chord blues group.
Yeah, and then just, I don't know, get a rapper over it, like put some trap beat, like, what? You know, like, go experimental with it. But I think he has a solid idea of the kind of sound he wants.
Okay.
Which is a bit more current. I'm not gonna pigeonhole it now. I mean, we'll hear it when it comes out. Yeah. So I guess that's interesting. Yeah. Yeah, I think it's a chance for us to really just not be so poppy anymore, I guess. Yeah.
So it's like a maturation of this. It's like One Direction. I mean, you got Harry Styles.
Possibly. Yeah. That's a good example. But I think at the heart of it, it's just really allowing us to let the brand simmer for a little bit and then grow again, you know, with every healthy thing. I think that's the goal.
One last thing is, okay, so I'm always curious about this. You can invite 3 other people to your dinner.
Wow!
From the music world in Singapore, past or present, dead or alive.
Oh, music world!
In Singapore, past or present, dead or alive. Music or acting or art in general.
Well, that's tough. 3, yeah.
3, yeah. Just 3.
Wow, what a question. Singapore, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
Who do you want to hear from?
You need to meet this guy. His name is Dr. Sydney Tan. Okay. Dr. Sydney.
He produced the National Day song last year, right?
He's been producing National Day songs every year. He's been doing the parade for years now.
Is it?
Okay. Yeah. He's done SEA Games, he's done that. He's a close collaborator of Dick Lee. But more than anything, he is a full-ass legit doctor.
Yeah. He's a useful doctor.
He's straight up a doctor. He's 9 to 6 doctor. 8 to 6, probably.
Yeah.
And then he tabs out, goes back home into his, like, attic studio, and just becomes this musical genius in charge of like the nation's sound.
Wow, that's amazing.
And this year for National Day, he's pulled together over 100 musicians and artists spanning from you know, the Rani Singham era, you know, like the Robert Fernandez era, like all back in the day in the 70s all the way to now, to sort of chart the
like evolution of our sound,
the tapestry of the Singapore music, and they're all coming together for National Day, and we're all doing it for Dr. Sydney Tan. It's for this dude. So and he's literally like the Merdeka generation creating like modern beats.
Yeah,
that's how insane he is. Yeah. What other producer would be able to do that right now? So he has that ability to adapt. Yeah. It's crazy. So definitely he's there. I always love talking to Charlie Lim, if you know Charlie. So what we do is we usually do a boxing session. We go hit each other in the face, and we sit down over coffee and talk about life.
Very good.
Which has been our thing for the past 6 months. Just like, let's go trash it out, and then let's get together. Let's talk about life, you know?
Yeah.
And he's one of those guys that like I can just like sit and listen to all day. Yeah. Just from his, and you have a lovely time talking to him.
He's like a professor of music in a way. I mean,
he is. But more than anything, he listens.
Yeah.
If you realize about him, like if I sit down with him, he's always in a state of learning, and he always comes across as not knowing jack shit.
Yeah.
You know, in intensely humble, and always trying to figure out where he is, and then he puts something out, and he's like, "Come on, dude! Like, what is this? This is something like, bloody insane." And Jasmine Sokol. So Jasmine again is one of those, I think, kids that just came out of nowhere, but just really, again, she's her own artist, she's her own producer, and she just is the concept artist of everything. Yeah. And she really embodies, like, I think the new wave of Singapore musicians.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Amazing.
So I guess these three, kind of like past, present, future.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they're also alive, so that's good. So it can actually happen if you want to.
Was it? Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because it did or alive.
Oh, I didn't think anyone did. Lee Kuan Yew, take her.
You also, why didn't know?
Now, while I'm not sure that Lee Kuan Yew would join Ben for dinner, I would think that most creatives in Singapore would jump at the chance to speak to Ben. He has a wealth of knowledge about the creative industry and has such wonderful insight about navigating and succeeding in the business. Ben's success both with the Sam Willows and on his own has not come as an accident. His achievements are the culmination of strategic planning, business acumen, hard work, talent, and a special determination that I think was honed from those endless hours spent staring at that blue line in the sports school swimming pool. Thank you, Ben, for being so candid with your experiences. Now, if you like what you're hearing, then please subscribe. We're on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And get in touch on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram using the handle @boldbutgoldsg or visit boldbutgoldsg.com. We'll be back again real soon with another episode about Singaporeans who are doing things their own way. I'll see you next time.